the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015. Greece will hold snap elections in a few weeks, even as it continues to struggle with its economy and the new problem of thousands of incoming migrants. We'll turn to Kostas Panayotakis. Plus, mass protests in Lebanon are demanding the resignation of the environment minister under the hashtag #YouStink. We'll go live to Beirut and a conversation with Professor Melissa N. Stein on her new book, Measuring Manhood, Race and the Science of Masculinity. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Courtney Morris. She's an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Sonali.
A United Nations agency has just released a damning report on Gaza, warning that it could be uninhabitable within 5 years. According to the report by the UN Conference on Trade and Development, quote, the social, health and security related ramifications of the high population density and overcrowding are among the factors that may render Gaza unlivable by 2020. Nearly 2 million Palestinians live in one of the most densely populated regions in the world. Several years of aggressive and bloody wars by Israel, coupled with a strict blockade, have rendered the territory on the verge of collapse. The report warned that it was even too late for aid agencies, saying, quote, short of ending the blockade, donor aid will not reverse the ongoing de-development and impoverishment in Gaza. Water, food, shelter, electricity and employment are all in severely short supply. Well, Courtney, how serious is the situation in Gaza and how seriously will the U.S. take this report, given that Israeli policies in Gaza are carried out with U.S. blessing and weapons?
Well, I mean, I think the situation is pretty clear, is pretty critical, as the report demonstrates. And this is something that NGOs, non-governmental organizations and human rights organizations have been saying for quite some time now to no avail. And the numbers are really just staggering. I just have to share this with you. I mean, 20,000 homes, 148 schools, 15 hospitals, 45 healthcare centers were destroyed last year during Operation Protective Edge. 247 factories, 300 commercial centers destroyed. Unemployment is 44%. And the military operation last summer has effectively destroyed whatever was left of the middle class in Gaza. And so, and you combine that with the fact that from December of last year, well into the spring of this year, the Israeli government was withholding Palestinian tax revenue from the occupied territories in retaliation for the Palestinian Authority attempting to seek membership in the International Criminal Court in The Hague in order to try to force Israel to honor the existing peace accords that it has with the Palestinian Authority. I think that it's pretty obvious that what's happening here is essentially a tactic of collective punishment of the Palestinian people.
Right.
And the message is clear. If you don't get out, we'll starve you out.
And court hearings have begun this morning in Baltimore, Maryland, in the police-related death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray. Gray died days after he was arrested by police in April from critical spinal injuries. His death sparked one of the biggest public rebellions nationwide over the past year. Six officers who were indicted in connection with Gray's death will find out in the hearings whether they will be tried separately, see any of their charges dismissed, or whether the prosecutor will be recused. Baltimore State's attorney Marilyn Mosby announced a surprisingly large number of charges against the six officers in what was one of the very rare cases of police being legally questioned for their role in a fatal encounter. Hundreds of people are expected to protest outside the courthouse, and news media are reporting that there is a heavy police presence. Courtney, do you think that there will be enough news coverage of this court case? Just because six officers have been heavily charged doesn't mean any of them will actually be convicted, right?
Well, certainly. I mean, of course, there, you know, all of this really remains to be seen, and a lot can happen during the course of a criminal prosecution. But I think that, you know, certainly there is reason for cautious optimism. I mean, it's certainly the first time in recent memory that we've seen police officers facing this number of criminal charges for the wrongful death of an unarmed civilian. So, you know, I do think for those reasons, it will certainly continue to attract a great deal of media attention. But more importantly, I think what we're seeing here is that the people of Baltimore are very angry about the death of Freddie Gray. And they're also very angry about the long history of abuses of civil rights of civilians in the city at the hands of the police that have really never been subjected to criminal prosecution. So I think really what's going to be the determining factor here is the people of Baltimore continuing to put pressure on the legal system there to ensure that that justice is served.
And finally, a 17-year-old transgender student is facing the wrath of hundreds of fellow students and parents in her Missouri school and community, all for using the bathroom. Leela Perry has found herself at the center of a firestorm after she used the girls' locker room during a phys ed class. She had previously been using a unisex faculty bathroom. When her use of the facilities prompted a two-hour protest by fellow students, Perry hid in a school counselor's office, worrying for her own safety. A Christian organization named Alliance Defending Freedom has taken up the fight against Perry's use of the bathroom. The Missouri Gay Straight Alliance Network plans a rally in support of her later this week. In early July, the U.S. Department of Justice ruled in favor of the rights of a transgender teenager in Virginia to use the bathroom assigned to the gender he identifies with, not his biological sex. Several school districts around the country have begun adjusting their bathroom use policies in line with that decision. Now, Courtney, it seems like a trivial matter, but given the high level of violence that trans youth face and also the high rates of suicide, how important is the right to just use the bathroom of one's choice?
About as important as the right to sit wherever you want to sit on the bus. I think that this is clearly much bigger than a bathroom. I think the real issue here is whether trans youth have the right to be who they are in public and to be accepted by their peers and by their community. And unfortunately, in this young woman's case, she's finding that the answer is still no. None of the parents or the students who have been protesting about her presence in these spaces has complained about her being aggressive or threatening to any of the other young women in that space. So it's not about safety. It's not about personal choice. It's about policing people's gender performance. And that, I think, is really a problem. And we're seeing the effects that this has on trans youth. I mean, just over the last year, the data has been overwhelming that, approximately it's estimated that 41% of trans youth have attempted suicide as the result of these kinds of forms of exclusion by their communities and discrimination in the public sphere. And so this is really so much bigger than a bathroom.
Courtney, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye, Sonali.
Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Greeks will once more head to the poll within a few weeks after embattled Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras resigned. Mr. Tsipras had called for the earliest possible elections, which will now take place on September 20th, and could enable him to consolidate his popularity and return to power. The Syriza party, to which Mr. Tsipras belongs, is facing a likely split by election time. In the meantime, Vasiliki Thanou was sworn in as prime minister of a caretaker government for the next several weeks. Ms. Thanou, who is Greece's fifth prime minister in 4 years, also holds the distinction of being the country's first female PM. Already, the first installment of a European bailout fund was trickling through Greece's economy, but even as the future remained uncertain, Greece has been struggling with the ramifications of a major migrant crisis on its doorstep. Thousands of Arab and African refugees have entered the struggling European nation, fleeing war and poverty, even as Greeks themselves are struggling. 12 Syrian migrants reportedly drowned while trying to make it to Greece yesterday. Joining me today is Kostas Panayotakis. He's a professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of Remaking Scarcity: From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. Welcome back to the program, Kostas.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, this whole Greek story has been so interesting, unpredictable, convoluted, and increasingly complex. But for our American audiences, there's the added complexity of trying to understand an unfamiliar government system. Can you first explain for our American audiences who may not be familiar with the parliamentary system, how it is that Mr. Tsipras can just call for new elections and why he is doing so?
Yeah, basically, Greece has a multi-party system. It's a parliamentary system. What that means is that when there is a national election, people vote for a party. And depending on how well a party does, it gets a number of deputies in the parliament. The Greek parliament has 300 deputies. So any government, in order to have a majority, it needs to have a majority in the government, in the parliament, in order to pass any legislation. So the last government had, the Syriza party had 149 deputies as a result of the January election, so they didn't quite have a majority. So they had made a coalition with a right-wing anti-austerity party called Independent Greeks, and together they had 162, which gave them a majority. But because of Syriza leader's about turn and the fact that the negotiation forced the Syriza government to accept a continuation of austerity, about 40 members of the Syriza party, 40 deputies, did not support this about turn, and they did not vote for the legislation. So basically the government lost its majority in the parliament, and it had to rely on votes from the opposition in order to pass the new agreement with the austerity measures that it involves. And because of that, Tsipras resigned, and of course he's going to run again for re-election. And his hope was that since the polls up to July showed that he was still very popular, that he could win the election, and while getting rid, of course, of the dissident deputies, and be able to have a new, more stable majority in the parliament. So it remains to be seen whether his calculations were correct. There are some recent polls. They're not necessarily fully reliable because they took place in August when most people are away. But this first poll showed that, the race will be much closer than the poll showed back in June and July.
Right, and a poll today found that Syriza could win about 26% of the vote, and that this decision to hold new elections could backfire. Is there any political significance to who he has appointed as his caretaker replacement? Judge Vasiliki Tanu, who became the first female prime minister that Greece has ever had?
Well, she's the top judge in Greece, one of the top judges. The other three sort of top courts in Greece. So she would be the equivalent of the head of the Supreme Court. And in situations like this, that's who gets appointed. So strictly speaking, she wasn't chosen by Tsipras himself. She's she's responsible for carrying out the elections and, of course, managing any important issues in the meantime, including the refugee issue, and she's supposed to carry out the elections in a kind of neutral, objective manner.
Aren't Greeks sick of going to the polls? I mean, in addition to the elections in January, there was a referendum over the bailout in the early part of the summer. Not only are Greeks expected to go for a third time this year to the polls, elections also cost money, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, basically, this is the charge. One of the main criticisms by the opposition was that this election was unnecessary and that it is destabilizing the country, and so on and so forth. And polls show that most Greeks did not think these elections were necessary or desirable. Basically, what has happened is that the Syriza government does not have a mandate for continuing these austerity policies. This austerity, it was elected back in January to basically reverse these austerity policies, and the Greek population's opposition to austerity was resoundingly reaffirmed in the July referendum, where over 60% of Greeks voted against the continuation of austerity policies and against the kind of agreement that Tsipras ended up signing. So basically, I think, from the point of view of the Syriza leadership, the function or the purpose of this referendum is to, in a way, make the no vote in the referendum to sort of make people forget that no vote and to basically legitimize his decision to basically go against what the referendum decided and to legitimize his decision to continue austerity.
Well, this sounds like a big mess. I mean, the fact that this party that campaigned on anti-austerity is now attempting to win back a Greek public that it had educated and pushed to reject austerity and convince them to re-elect them in order to implement austerity packages sounds pretty schizophrenic.
Yeah, and it's disappointing for many people. It's disorienting for the base of the party. The party, you know, is facing a big crisis. There was a split already. So the deputies that voted, who voted no, have already formed the party, and they're going to run in the election on an anti-austerity platform. And there is a lot of disorientation and discontent within Syriza, because basically there is a sense that Tsipras and his immediate surroundings are making the decisions without necessarily consulting with the party, and that you know, even before he announced the elections, he had proposed a congress of the party where the new situation would be discussed, the new strategy would be discussed, and then he, you know, announces the election before the congress can take place. So in a certain way, he forces the party to follow him in his new line. And even the many people who, you know, might have been willing to support the about turn see this as being very undemocratic. So this probably has demoralizing effects within the Syriza party. And that will probably affect Syriza's performance in the election. And it also, this kind of about turn also re-legitimizes austerity policies. There is a new narrative now that, you know, now we all know that the austerity and anti-austerity issue that was the central axis of the elections in the past is supposedly dead. Now we know that, you know, austerity is inevitable. So the question is, who can manage austerity more competently? Who can? And Syriza's claim is that, you know, it will find ways to implement austerity in ways that are more socially sensitive and more socially just. And I think this is a new illusion, just as before the January election, it proved that it was impossible for Greece to reverse austerity within the Eurozone. Now there is this new promise that, okay, we will continue this austerity program, but somehow we will find a way to, you know, mitigate its effects.
Kostas, let's talk about the added complication of what else Greece is dealing with, and that is an influx of migrants fleeing war and poverty. There's been some violent incidents and interactions in various parts of Greece, like Kos and the island of Lesbos. There have been thousands of migrants that have been arriving in Greece, primarily, of course, because of Greece's geographic position. How much does this complicate efforts within Greece to deal with its own economic crisis?
Yeah, I mean, it makes it very hard, the general situation where you have a government with very strained finances makes it hard to manage the situation well and to provide the kind of conditions that refugees deserve. And there is another complication, which has, of course, to do that with the fact that all these refugees do not want to stay in Greece because they know that, you know, this is a country where there is no future for Greeks themselves, let alone for people coming from the outside. So they are hoping to move towards Northern Europe. So this is a crisis that in some ways is not just a Greek crisis, it's a European crisis, and it's really a global crisis. So there have been some moves for the Europeans to decide how to handle this. There have been some moves for Germany to allow more of these refugees to come in. But at the same time, we see the rise of xenophobia and racism, both in Greece, but also throughout Europe as well. So it's a very complicated situation. I mean, this is all different manifestations of the global capitalist crisis we are in the midst of. You know, the European economic crisis and the refugee crisis that is linked to instability and turmoil in you know, the countries of the Middle East and North Africa and so on and so forth.
About 23,000 migrants arrived in Greece last week alone, and that's double the number from the previous week. Are conservative parties in Greece using the migration crisis to gain political capital?
Yeah, I mean, there have been statements. Certainly there is the Golden Dawn neo-Nazi party that is, you know, it was a marginal force, political force, before the crisis that began in 2010. And by now, they have become the third largest party in the Greek parliament. So they are hoping to capitalize on that. But what is also disturbing is some of the mainstream country parties in Greece are also flirting with xenophobic statements. You know, the opposition, some of the figures of the opposition, basically attacking Syriza, saying that its recent liberalization of the immigration law is attracting supposedly refugees. And then you have even small parties of the center left claiming that Greece has a policy of open borders and so on and so forth. So yeah, there is a certainly a danger that now that when it comes to economic policies, the differences have, become much smaller, that parties will try to generate support by assuming a populist right-wing, anti-immigration, racist, anti-refugee rhetoric.
Kostas, I want to thank you so much for joining us as always. I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future, and certainly we'll be following the story not only of the elections but the refugee crisis. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kostas Panayotakis is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His book is called Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll go live to Beirut. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Protesters in Beirut, Lebanon, stormed the offices of the Environment Ministry yesterday in the latest dramatic action of a growing anti-government movement. A fluid campaign under the hashtag YouStink is taking the government to task for not picking up trash for several weeks, stemming from a dispute over a landfill. The protesters have demanded the resignation of the Environment Minister, Mohamed Machnouk. The occupation of the Environment Ministry came on the heels of a major demonstration in central Beirut on Saturday, at which thousands of people showed up. In late July, hundreds of students and others were injured when security forces used live ammunition and tear gas to disperse protesters. But the rot has deeper roots than just a garbage crisis. Anger over political stagnation and corruption began as early as July. The government is unable to elect a new parliament and president. Joining me now live from Lebanon is Jackson Allers. He's a journalist, filmmaker, and writer based in Beirut. Welcome to Uprising, Jackson.
Thank you, Sonali.
Now, what has happened at the Environment Ministry since yesterday? There were threats to clear the offices, but protesters said that they wouldn't leave. We saw a lot of videos on social media from people who were occupying those premises, and they were sitting down. They didn't look like they were going to move.
Well, indeed, they were forced to leave, but against their will, of course. And it did get violent. One of the lead protest organizers, Lucien Bourgeli, actually sustained injuries after he was forcibly removed yesterday from the offices. They've essentially taken that as momentum to move it into the next round of demonstrations and protests. As it stands right now, the interior minister, who is another Mashnouk, actually Nohad Mashnouk, has said that it's unwise for the protesters to actually try to do this again, that they would basically see the brunt of the security forces in forcibly removing any protesters that decide to do this again, which is that's kind of a strategy that I would say the organizers are employing, in part because they need to show that the state and the government actors and the leaders themselves are essentially negating their cries for them to step down, especially Mohamed Mashnouk, the environment minister, who has been woefully handling the trash crisis as it's come up this summer. So they were forced out of the offices of Mohamed Mashnouk yesterday, but not without a lot of media attention and not without a lot of, let's say, support being galvanized, not just within Lebanon, but around the world, to support this protest movement.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jackson, can you explain what exactly has led to trash piling up on the streets? And if these protests are solely focused on that, or is that a symptom of something bigger?
Well, clearly it's a symptom of something bigger. Anyone that knows anything about the Lebanese political system knows that it's an apportioned system. It's a system that is, let's say, the pie is split between 18 different sects that all have their different representation in government. The trash crisis is what has brought all of this into the forefront. And essentially what we're talking about here is the trash crisis starts in Beirut as a municipality, and Jebel Mosen, which is Jebel Lebanon, which is an outlying municipality from Beirut. These are all part of one privatized contract that's given to a private garbage company, called Suclean. That contract is worth. It started in 1994 at $3.6 million to handle the trash needs of this district. Has since turned to a $150 million contract, which, as you can imagine, is quite an inflation. And the current bids that were being asked for the current, let's say, contracts for the trash waste management, was even higher, over $150 million. So because that contract wasn't approved, and because a lot of different elements within the system, both those who are in charge of putting the bids out and those who are in charge who are accepting the bids and then let's say creating the contracts from those, that's a very, very untransparent process. And as that was going on, trash was piling up. And that came to a fever pitch in July when basically nothing was solved, and trash for 2 to 3 weeks started to pile up. Now, the Beirut municipality has a landfill that they've been using since 1997. That was meant to be a temporary landfill that was at the most meant to last until 2001, but has since been used ever since. The residents of this community where the landfill exists, I think it was like 10 or 20 tons over the suggested usage, which essentially the residents revolted against the Suklin waste management company that was responsible for dumping, and to the Beirut municipality, they said no more. Once that happened, the trash started. The trash had nowhere to go, so it piled up on the streets. And in essence, what that showed was an incredible, let's say, hierarchy of cronyism from the top to the private companies that are responsible for the bidding. Within that whole process, you have a trash crisis that exists. That served essentially as the as they like to say in Arabic, the straw that breaks the camel's back. You basically, people, this is a health hazard. It's a basic issue within the governance of a municipality, of a government. You have to be able to deal with your waste. This government, in 20 plus years, has never effectively dealt with its waste management issues, and it has never come up with a national policy to deal with its waste management issues. That has then been taken by the protesters and then used as a way of showing the system with which this operates, which, as you said earlier, exposes a lot more about the system that is corrupt, that is rotten to the core.
What do the protesters want beyond the resignation of the Environment Minister Mohammed Mashnouk? Do they, and the government is itself experiencing its own crisis, unable to form a parliament or get a majority in parliament. What does, are there specific demands that people want beyond the resignation of the Environment Minister?
Well, here's the thing. With such an entrenched sectarian system that essentially came out of the civil war through the Taif Accord, which sanctioned this sectarian system, which gave the Speaker of the Parliament, the head of the Speaker of the Parliament, to the Shia sect, it gave the Prime Ministership to the Sunni sect, and it gave the presidency to the Christian sect, that essentially cemented this idea of apportioned representation and power sharing. When that happened, essentially, that created all that exists today in the way of the corruption and the lines of corruption and everything that has equaled, you know, a lack of infrastructure in every category: water, power, waste management, everything essentially. So what we're dealing with is the protesters. You are using a very specific platform, the protest organizers, which is a very sort of non-hierarchical leadership that's not giving itself the power to have a figurehead that could get taken down. They're very, very smart about how they've studied protest movements around the world. They essentially are using this issue to bring out other issues, but specifically they need the government, they're asking for the government to come up with a nationalized waste management plan. They are asking for there to be justice for the violence that was meted against the protesters in the first weekend, two weekends ago, and before. They're asking for that call of justice to have all of those that were brought to bear who let's say made the decision to propagate violence against these protesters that were nonviolent protesters. We have to be very clear about this. This is a nonviolent protest movement. And so as they are, let's say, so you've got the garbage crisis, they're dealing with the nationalized policy, they're dealing with the removal of Mohammed Mashnouk, the environment minister, and the interior minister, Mohammed Mashnouk, because essentially that is who, at the end of the day, gives the order to do what the riot police do. This is the internal security forces. He ends up controlling these folks. Now, past that, of course, they want to start dealing with other elements of the broken system, but they want this to be the thing that exposes to the Lebanese people what it is that they've pledged their loyalties to and their allegiances to, essentially to leaders that are, to their core, corrupt and have not done what they promised over decades to take care of the most basic needs of their constituents. So they're very clear that this has a very specific aim to expose other things, but that in the least you have to deal with the trash because it is a massive health risk for the population. People around me, my peers, everyone is getting sick now. It's not a joke.
Wow.
People are literally getting sick because I live close to what is called Nahar Beirut, the Beirut River, and they burn trash every night now that they don't have a place to dump it. This filters into everybody's households on the trade winds and the winds as they come into people's houses. You can't get away from this. So at the very least, dealing with this trash issue has to be done. There's no way around this, and the government will not be able to find a way around this. This is the, if you will, the positive element of the protesters' demands. They know that the government will expose themselves if they do not deal with this properly.
Finally, Jackson, what about the fact that Hezbollah has also recently thrown its weight behind the protests? Has that complicated matters?
Well, the protest organizers and everyone involved in this, if you had been out here on Saturday, you would have seen 120 to 150,000 people who were not flying the colors of their parties or religious affiliations. This is what makes this unprecedented. Hezbollah throwing their weight behind this, Michelle Aoun and the Free Patriotic Movement who threw their weight behind this briefly and then pulled it out, who's an ally to Hezbollah. It's clear they're saying at all levels of government, all leaderships, including Hezbollah, there is corruption, and that is true. Now, the resistance, Hezbollah as a resistance, that's another thing. That has to do with its relationship to Israel. Now, Hezbollah coming in and saying, we throw our weight behind the protesters. The protesters do not care. The protester organizers do not care. They do not want Hezbollah's support. They, in fact, in essence, if you had seen what happened on Saturday, this is slowly, in my opinion, drawing power from these other political parties because everybody at the most basic levels is fed up with the ineptitude. And I think that's when you talk about Hezbollah coming in and saying, yes, we support the protesters, that is all just political gamesmanship. And if at the end of the day, what Hezbollah is able to do in the political vacuum is they do provide social services in ways the government and the state cannot. But this is something else. This is waste management. Waste management is something that has a very specific chain of command and lineage in a business sense and in a practical sense. So the Hezbollah is throwing their weight behind this does not affect the protest movement in the sense that they do not see anyone in this political process as their allies. They are looking to the people themselves. They want this to be a populist movement, and that is what is happening.
Well, we'll certainly follow the story and see where it lands. And of course, our audience can go to twitter.com and search under the hashtag YouStink. Are there any other websites that you'd like to give out, Jackson?
I think the best thing to do is to that hashtag is the most viable way of finding information. You can do that on Facebook. You can do that on Twitter. Essentially, just search the web on that hashtag YouStink. Some are calling this the garbage revolution, and I think that if it leads to a revolution, that's something that people wouldn't mind calling it. But certainly, you need to look at hashtag YouStink to find out what's going on.
Thank you so much, Jackson, for joining us. Best of luck to you.
My pleasure, Sonali.
Jackson Allers is a journalist, filmmaker, and writer based in Beirut. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The notion that science is a dispassionate undertaking and that scientific inquiry is led by evidence and peer-reviewed study is not true today and certainly not true historically. The human prejudices of scientists regularly emerge, not only to taint their results, but often to buttress those biases. The story of how scientists and their work have reinforced racist and sexist stereotypes, or what is called biological determinism, is told in a new book by Melissa N. Stein called Measuring Manhood, Race and the Science of Masculinity, 1830 to 1934. Stein is an assistant professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Kentucky. She now joins me. Welcome to Uprising.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this is, of course, an issue that many people, particularly students of the history of science, with a lens for racism and looking at racism in the past have known. But what I liked about your book was that you very specifically called out some people, some, you know, the mostly men, who have in the history of science really done a disservice to science, but also to society. One of the early proponents of biological determinism in your book that you call out was Thomas Jefferson, whose views of African Americans was so skewed that he wondered if blacks were a different species of humans to whites. That's not surprising, given that he was a slave owner, right?
Right. You know, what people are less familiar with in regards to Thomas Jefferson is that he basically issued the call to arms for science to take up the study of racial difference, to kind of settle this question as to whether or not African Americans were an entirely different species, as he suspected. And, you know, scientists do, in fact, answer that call to arms in the throughout the 19th century and into the 20th, kind of directly answering Thomas Jefferson's questions about race and racial difference.
Now, you explain in your book that, quote, ethnology was a field of scientific inquiry premised on the belief that the physical body revealed the intellectual, moral, and political capacities of its owner, and by implication, those of his or her own race writ large. So how did this scientific field of ethnology contribute to racist notions, and how did it get used to justify slavery as acceptable? I mean, these were scientists who were literally measuring the body parts of people.
That's correct. And what you see here, though, is a very interesting kind of back and forth relationship between scientists and the society around them. These scientists depend on the social relevance of their claims in order to actually build this new professional field and to be taken seriously as scientists, right? So their claims are, quoted and passed around by politicians in the 19th century. There are plenty of pro-slavery politicians, and then after the Civil War, politicians who are opposing black enfranchisement, for example, black men getting the vote or black men keeping the vote, will actually directly cite some of these scientific studies that, that use biology to prove that African Americans are not biologically built for citizenship or for social equality, political equality, and so on. But the scientists themselves also need to be relevant. They need to make claims that buttress their status as kind of social doctors, as it were, and experts on America's race problems, sex problems, problems of sexuality, and so on.
Let's name some of these men. John Campbell was one. He was a labor organizer, but he was troubled by what he called the falsely assumed equality between races. Tell us about his contribution.
Well, and I start one of the early chapters with him to kind of disrupt the expectation that the reader might come in with that all the scientists that I'm talking about are surely Southern, or are surely slave owners themselves, pro-slavery, what have you. But John Campbell is himself an immigrant from Ireland in the mid-19th century, and he's very, as you pointed out, very pro-labor, but he believes that the only way there can be equality among whites, of which he includes himself, is by the subjugation of a slave class. There's, you know, this kind of science of race makes some very strange bedfellows. One of the largest hubs for ethnology as this developing field in the 19th century is actually Philadelphia, which is, the city of ostensibly of brotherly love. It's the kind of heart of the American Revolution. It's in the North. It is not pro-slavery by the time that ethnology has really taken root. But there are, slavery has this interesting relationship to ethnology too, because there are plenty of anti-slavery ethnologists that are making very similar claims about Black inequality, but using those claims to contest slavery with equally racist logic, right? That slavery is an abuse of power by a superior race against an inferior childlike race that needs protecting because of their inferiority, much in the way that they would talk about children. So many of the scientists are Northern. All the Northern scientists are not necessarily anti-slavery. John Campbell, was pro-slavery. John Van Every is a New York scientist that I talk a lot about, and he is one of the most vehement pro-slavery voices throughout the 19th century, even after slavery, ends after the Civil War, at least in legal language, it ends, if not necessarily in the lived experience of African Americans in the South. But he is adamantly pro-slavery.
And there's Josiah Nott, who you also write about. He wrote the book Types of Mankind, and I was so surprised by the detailed illustrations of the shapes and the sizes of the heads and the body parts of humans, but also animals. These scientists obviously tried to get very precise to show that their conclusions, their preconceived conclusions, had some backing in reality. But, I mean, if we put how detailed did these measurements get? And you know, we can sort of look back on this as being ludicrous. But there are still some people citing these texts today.
There absolutely is. Types of Mankind, it was originally published in 1854. And it was, even at the time, kind of an anthology of ethnological writing. So it had some essays by Samuel Morton, the famous Philadelphia collector of skulls, who died prior to the book's publication. Some by some Egyptologists and so on. The majority of it was written by Josiah Nott, but he also compiled writing from others. It was published in 1854. It had already gone through 10 reprintings by the 1860s, and continues to be republished even today by, in some cases, by kind of like white supremacist presses. But it was mainstream at the time that it was published. You know, it may not be republished today by mainstream presses, but it certainly was at the time. And it had a mainstream audience as well. Josiah Nott is often the ethnologist that people are most familiar with when they think of ethnology.
Right. Now, what was the main difference between ethnologists sort of in terms of the time that you look at? You draw a line between the pre-Civil War era ethnologists and then post-Civil War, that before the Civil War, the focus was primarily on men, on males, and measuring manhood, as your book title suggests. But then it sort of also broadened to include women after the Civil War.
Yes, and who the scientists are looking at, you know, in terms of as a site for examining racial difference is really contingent on when they're looking. Prior to the Civil War and directly after, during Reconstruction, they continue to look primarily at male bodies because that's it's men whose lives have the most political import, right? And the vote, is a very present issue. But they do look at women's bodies immediately leading up to the Civil War around these kind of political questions of the expansion of slavery into the Western territories and which states are going to be slave states, which states are going to be free. And they're making these claims by looking at Black women's bodies as somehow biologically built for reproduction, but for not just for reproductive labor, you know, bearing more slaves, but also for productive labor, for laboring in the fields. So they use Black women's bodies to say that slavery is not only natural, that it's thriving through the lens of Black women's bodies and can and must expand into the territories because they are so, the slave women are so hyper reproductive, mm-hmm. And that slavery must be given a space to expand.
Yeah.
But to kind of go back to your previous question about how detailed the measurements, one of the best examples is actually during the Civil War itself, when the Union Army, now again, this is, you know, ostensibly a anti-slavery context, the Union Army is measuring the bodies of soldiers, living bodies, right? They're doing anthropometric studies, and anthropometrics kind of measures the proportions of different body parts, like the length of the forearm in comparison to the whole arm and so on. And they're trying to do everything with these very, very exact measuring tools. And it's simply a matter of numbers, right, to them, and that numbers don't lie. But even, you know, even they interpret their own results through the lens of what they already expect to see in regards to racial difference.
Now, there were, of course, Black intellectuals who were fighting back against this sciencizing of racism, to put it crudely.
Yes.
And I think that's a really important part of the story. Tell us about mm-hmm. Walter White, not the Breaking Bad character,
yes.
but a very important activist with the NAACP. He was actually a very light-skinned African-American. There was also David Walker, who wrote the pamphlet, Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. How did these Black intellectuals fight back?
For one thing, they did so in a very kind of catch-22 situation, right? Another example is Frederick Douglass, who is not only an advocate for abolition, but also later for the vote for Black men and for women, right? He's kind of got an early intersectional analysis that, as we might think of it today, he's a good example of this kind of catch-22 because he is an esteemed intellectual. He does travel the country doing these speaking gigs and so on, and he uses his own success as an example of the fallacy of these scientific claims about Black intellectual deficits, right? But these scientists are, simply explain away his intellectual accomplishments by referencing, his white blood, that he has some mixed race heritage. There's always a convenient answer, right, to fight back against these kind of Black intellectuals who are challenging scientific racism. But they do so in really, these primarily men, Black men, do make some very, very pertinent challenges and really powerful challenges. But until Walter White, which is why I devoted an entire chapter to him, a lot of these earlier figures like David Walker and Frederick Douglass maybe not so much Frederick Douglass, but C.V. Roman is a Black doctor at the turn of the century. They lack something that Walter White has in the 1920s and 30s, and that's an interracial audience. Walter White has
So he was more they were more effective in getting the word out.
Right. Walter White had a bigger audience.
Well, Melissa, we just have a couple of minutes left, and just want to bring up the fact that your book is a historic book. Coverage is 1830 to 1934. However, how relevant is this history today? I mean, we, of course, have all heard of Larry Summers, who is president of Harvard University, talked about, quote, innate differences between men and women, as if to suggest women were inferior and less intelligent. But that was in 2005, 10 years ago. Do you still see such sentiments on race and gender being expressed publicly in the mainstream?
Absolutely. And not only expressed publicly, but it's also sort of an implicit belief system that people have carried through in American culture. I teach a class that deals with a lot of the issues raised in the book. It's called Gender, Race, and Science, and I'm teaching it right now. And I always start the class, asking students if they've heard of any of these kind of ideas about biological differences between the races. And one that they have all heard of, and that everyone says, well, it's just a scientific thing, but no one can cite the exact study, is this belief that Black people have an extra bone in their leg that makes them better athletes, and also therefore explains away any athletic achievements that Black athletes have made. Wow. Right? And that's one that just sort of persists. The idea of men and women having different brains, left brain, right brain, or they learn differently, that one persists. You do hear these studies continue to be cited on things like Dateline, 2020, and so on, about, the female brain as a rationale for single-sex education, or for allowing male students to have, more breaks to run around because they need to be active, and so on. These studies not only continue to be cited, but they continue to shape policy, political policy, educational policy, and so on.
Melissa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you with the new book.
Thank you very much.
My guest is Melissa N. Stein. She's an assistant professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Kentucky, and we've been discussing her book, Measuring Manhood, Race and the Science of Masculinity. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. And Teddy Robinson and Kiana Turner are our audio engineers. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Uprising Radio. Our theme song is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.